If you don't have your Bibles out already, Exodus is where we're going to be for the next several months. So go ahead and keep your Bible open to Exodus chapter 3. One of the things that I miss about not living in the country, I don't know if you've ever lived in the country, but one of the things I miss about not living in the country is not being able to make a fire. I don't know about you, but I love fires. I love to sit around a campfire. Actually, there's not much I'd rather do on a cool night than make a fire and just sit there and watch it. I could do that for hours because there's something about a fire. Do you know what I mean? There's something about a fire that makes me curious and yet at the same time content. Like I could sit there and my mind could be full of thought, really pondering out of the midst of that fire the mysteries of the universe and at the same time be content. There's all kinds of pondering and yet this peaceful feeling that I have when I sit there and just watch a fire. Now, it's also helpful to have a nice beverage, maybe some snacks and some marshmallows at the same time. But there's something so simple about a fire, and yet there's so much to it, right? Fire is one of the things, one of the few things in the universe that is simultaneously terrifying and inviting. Right? You guys know what I'm talking about? So knowing what we do about fire and how it makes us feel, that it draws us in, and at the same time, we're afraid of it, right? If you're not afraid of fire, like if you think, hey, I'm going to pick up that coal, you're insane, right? There's nobody in their right mind that thinks, hey, that's a good idea to do. And so knowing what we do about fire, and yet it's so dangerous, and yet it's so inviting for us, it shouldn't be any surprise to us that when God finally decides to reveal himself in this story of Exodus, he does so as a flame, right? He reveals himself in this fire. We've been watching him so far throughout the story of Exodus orchestrate the impossible in order to set up the rescue of his people, but he hasn't yet really revealed himself in the story. But now, this God, who is both inviting and terrifying, makes himself known in the stories. Chances are you're pretty familiar with this story, at least in concept. Even if you went to a vacation Bible school as a kid, you know, everybody has probably heard of Moses in the burning bush. And the irony of the story is that the bush is on fire, but it's not being consumed. Unlike the campfires that we make, the bush is not being consumed. And so there is a lot that we could say about this passage. We read the whole chapter. We're covering the whole chapter. But we're going to hone in on some of the most important aspects of what we see in this chapter. And so here's where we're going to go with this morning. Because in this text, God is revealing himself to his people in this story, we're going to go ahead and let him do that. Okay, this morning, we're going to let God reveal himself to us, and we're going to let this text help us rightly understand the nature of who God is. And there's some very specific things that he's communicating to us about himself in this text. Here's what he's revealing to us. God's revealing to us that he is holy, that God is holy, that he is above all. He's above us. He's above creation. He's above everything. There is no God like our God. But he's also revealing to us that he is near, that he's among us, that he's with us. And so God is holy. Let's talk real quick about what that when it means. What does it mean that God's holy? Because it's one of those words that we can hear, we kind of know what it means, but it's just kind of elusive to us at times. So in everyday terms, here's what holy means. There is nothing or no one like God. There's nothing or no one like God. God is completely distinct from everything. He is his own category, all right? He's utterly unique. He is so far different from who we are that he has his own category. And so it's not like we're kind of the same as God. Now, don't get me wrong, we're created in his image, but in terms of who God is, it's not like we're the same, but he's just a little more advanced in intelligence and creativity and purity. No, God is his own. And in saying that God is holy, that he is above us. And even in the way that we learn about this holiness of God, the way that he's revealing himself to us in this fire, we learn a very big truth about God and the way that God operates and about the Bible and about Christianity and how all of this affects our life just in the way that God is revealing himself to us. And because what we learn is that God is self-defining. God defines himself. So, and he's defining himself as holy, right? We know that specifically because as Moses approaches, God says, "Whoa, take your shoes off. Because my presence is here, this is now holy ground." God is revealing himself as holy. He is self-defining. Now, can you see a problem with that in our culture? We live in a time when people think they get to define God as whoever or whatever they think God is like. And of course, everybody's entitled to their opinion, but we want to make God in our image, don't we? We believe, our culture believes that we get to say who he is. So you hear people talk like this all the time, and if you stop and think about it, it's crazy. I mean, it really is insane if we think realistically about what we're saying, that when someone says, "Well, I don't think God would do that," or, you know, "God, if God was really loving, he would do this," or "he wouldn't do that," there's a sense in which when we think about God and we think about what God should be like and we start to then form an opinion about who God is in our mind, which is really not based on reality or truth, it's based on us and how we feel and our past and the hurts in our lives and the things we want in life, right? We want to create a God that's going to allow us to be who we want to be and do what we want to do so that then we can feel okay about it, right? But in doing that, aren't we just creating a concept? Aren't we taking God out of reality and just creating something that we can bend and form in our image? But God won't be bent. God will not be bent. God defines God. We don't define God. And so the insanity of thinking that you can define God is like me coming up to you and saying, "Hey, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream?" And you answer me, "German Shepherd." I'm like, "Bro, German Shepherd's a dog. It's not ice cream." No, it is. No, a German Shepherd is a canine, has four legs. Eventually, you just have to leave the conversation, right? Because you have left reality. There is no conversation. I'm not talking to you about dog ice cream, right? It doesn't make sense. And that sounds crazy because we'd never talk like that. But it's the same thing when we do that with God. It really is no different. We take who he is and we make him something completely other than that. We try to make him like us. But he's holy. He has a completely separate, distinct category in the universe. And in this passage, God is introducing himself with his personal name. So he's not only defining who he is as an attribute, as a character, he's telling us his name. So let's look at verse 14 together. "And God said to Moses, 'I am who I am.' And he said, 'Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you.'" Hey, what's your name? I am. Come again. Like, that doesn't that seem intentionally designed to blow our minds or confuse us? It just doesn't make sense in our language and in our category of who we are, right? Because when I ask you who you are and you say, "I am," there should be something to follow, right? Like, who am I? I'm a dad. I'm a husband. I'm a pastor. I'm from here. I do this, right? We have to identify ourselves as something, but not God. He doesn't say I'm this or I'm that. He just says I am. I am. I am who I am, or same translation, I am that I am. It's the verb to be. There's no beginning to it. There's no ending to it. It is just the continual state of being. That's who God is. That's his name. I am who I am. And so in the Bible, as you're reading the Bible, often the Bible will translate this word, I am who I am, as Yahweh or Jehovah. But the most common way you're going to see it in the Bible is when you read the Lord, but Lord is in all capital letters. That is God being, calling himself, being seen as, revealing himself as, I am that I am. And this was a very revered name for God, for the Jewish people. Over time, there were periods of time in history where they wouldn't even utter this word because it was seen as such a holy name. I am who I am. And in saying this about himself, God is saying, I have been who I have been. I will be who I will be. I have no end. I have no beginning. All that matters in the universe now and forevermore is me. That's it. This is a life-changing truth about the greatness and the transcendence and the holiness of God. And because this is true, we can believe that all the promises of God are true for us. Think about that in the context of the story we're going through. And all the impossible things that the people of God are going through, that the people of God are being enslaved and they're having their sons murdered by the Egyptians, and then Moses ends up being saved and preserved and put into a river and rescued by Pharaoh's own daughter, and then growing up in Pharaoh's house and being trained as an Egyptian, making him the perfect advocate to come back and return and rescue Egypt because he's Hebrew, but he's also Egyptian. And then everything seems to fall apart, right? And Moses finds himself out in the wilderness, but God can be trusted because of who God is, because I am who I am. He is the only stable being in the universe. Do you realize that? He's the only stable force. Forget about life form. There is nothing else in the universe that is stable and faithful and unchanging the way God is. And so he's able to keep his promises in a way that we can't. Look at verse 16. We're going to read a few verses here. So God says, go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, see that's all caps, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of the Egyptians to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey, and they will listen to your voice, and the elders, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and I will strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do. We're going to see that in the weeks to come. Verse 20. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty. But each woman shall ask of her neighbor, and any woman who lives in her house, they're going to ask for silver and gold and for clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and daughters. So you shall plunder the Egyptians. This is amazing, all right? And it messes us up a little bit because we know the end of the story. Some of you guys saw the movie, right? We know the end of the story. So we've already had the wow, aha moment. But listen, just go back and be amazed again. The great I am just said to Moses, this is what's going to happen. Can you do that? I can't do that. Hey, Moses, this is what's going to happen. You're going to go there. You're going to go to the elders and you're going to tell them what I said and they're going to believe you. And you're going to go to Pharaoh and you're going to tell him what I said. He's not going to believe you, but he's going to need a little motivation. So I'm going to stretch out my powerful hand. I'm going to bring him to his knees. I'm going to crush Egypt and you are going to plunder them. That's victory language. Moses, you are going to have victory over Egypt because of me. That's who God is. That's what God can do. This hasn't happened yet. Now, we know in the story it's going to happen. That's amazing. See, a war is about to break out between two I ams. I am Pharaoh. I'm the greatest ruler on planet Earth. I rule the most powerful nation, the most effective, educated, advanced nation to this point in history. I have the largest, most powerful army on earth, and I am who I am. Who says, Pharaoh, I'm going to destroy your nation, and I'm going to save my people. It's really not a war, because God's holy, because he's all powerful, but it is a war. Because Pharaoh's not going to give in to the creator of the universe. But we can't talk about this the way that God does. Like, hey, look, don't fear because this is what's going to happen, right? I can't even do that with house projects, right? I've learned this about myself. I can't count how many times my wife has said, hey, we need to fix that, or hey, can we upgrade that, or, you know, renovate this? And she's like, hey, why don't we hire somebody who knows what they're doing? And she doesn't say it like that because she knows that'll just push me even more. No, I can do it. I can do it. 2 hours, no sweat. 2 hours, I'll have this done. 36 hours later, 12 trips to Home Depot, I finally call somebody for help, right? Because I thought I knew. I didn't know what I didn't know. Now I know what I didn't know, but... And I still end up doing the same thing sometimes, right? Why? Because I think I know. I think I can predict what's going to happen. But I have no control over anything. How about you? Like, I like to think that I can. See, the Lord never thinks, well, oh, I think, maybe, oh, if that happens, well, we'll see how it goes. No. For him, it's, this is what's going to happen. This is what we're going to do. This is how this is going to be accomplished. I get into my housing projects hours later, and I realize I don't have a clue what I'm doing here. I got the thing all taken apart, right? Oh, you need a special tool for that. I finally got the tool. Oh, now I'm into it. I have no idea what this is. Oh, I broke that trying to fix this. Oh, I finally got that back together. It doesn't really look like it used to now, and it doesn't work like it used to. Are there other things in your life that you could relate that to? God is holy. God is holy and he is fully in control. And there's nothing that he doesn't know and there's nothing that he can't do. But he's not just holy, he's not just terrifying, he's also near. He's close to us. He cares about us. He's not just above us, he's among us. Look at verse 7. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings and I have come down to deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians. This God who revealed himself as holy, think about it, even in the bush, he's holy, high and lifted up. Moses can't even walk on the ground before him. Came down to Moses in a burning bush. He's there with him. And we'll see throughout the story, he continues to do this. This God who all of Scripture talks about this, he dwells in the heavens. No one can approach him in his light, in his purity, in his holiness. He does whatever he pleases. This immense, holy God, the sovereign King of glory, the King of all creation, is also among us. And he's with us. Jesus would be called Emmanuel, literally meaning God with us. Both the holiness and the nearness of God are true of him simultaneously, always. That's who he is. And it's important that we understand this about him. It's important that we understand how that plays out in our lives functionally as we view God and see God. See, the world is full of philosophy and religion based on either one side or the other, that God is transcendent and far removed and holy, or that he's near and close. But leaning to one side or the other and ignoring the other creates huge problems for us in our life. Understanding these two together is uniquely Christian. So there's plenty of religions that recognize God as high and removed. Eastern religions tend to look at God as being near and close, maybe a little too close sometimes, right? But see, if God is far and removed, if he's high and removed from humanity, removed from his creation, then we can know that God exists intellectually, and we can even believe in this God, but it doesn't really make a difference in our life and the way that we live because he's so far removed. On the other hand, if God is near but not holy, if he's transcendent, you know, God's everywhere, he's in everything, and wherever we go and whatever we do, we're connecting with the spiritual vibes all around us, and so, you know, we got this big spiritual mosh pit of being God together. There is no holiness about God in that. The focus of that is us, right? And the reality is you're not God. You're not God, I'm not God. The tree's not God, your dog's not God, the sand on the beach is not God. God is not in a shack explaining away your sin or the sin of others done towards you. God is God. And God reveals himself as God. And he reveals himself as both holy and he reveals himself as near. And that is the God of the Bible. That is who God is revealing himself to Moses as he's calling him to go rescue his people. So, I think the bottom line is, if we in our understanding of God ignore the holiness of God, we need to understand that there is no seriousness in our heart about sin. If we ignore the holiness of God, there's no seriousness in our heart about sin. And so you live as though God doesn't see. You live as though God doesn't hear. You live as though God doesn't care. Like there's not going to be an accounting for my life. And if that's the case, there's no holy fear of God in your life. And if that's the case, you're not striving for holiness in your life as you rest in grace. If you don't understand and believe the holiness of God, there will be no striving for holiness in your life as you rest in grace. Actually, I go as far as to say, if you are not striving for holiness because you don't understand the holiness of God, you don't understand grace. You don't know grace. What you think you know is grace is not grace. Because it's through understanding the holiness of God and how the holiness of God was satisfied for you that you understand grace. But as Christians, we say no to that. We see him as holy. We see him as above us, but also among us. And I think understanding these two together addresses a real problem that is happening in so many of us. I think somewhat at large in the church, but a lot of people who even claim to be Christians, this needs to be a point that's driven home for us in the church. Look at verse 11. But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He said, God said, "But I will be with you." It's an interesting exchange right here. Moses' question is the question that we can't seem to get a hold of and keep our grip on. And it's ruining us. It destroys us when we stray too far from the right answer of this question. The question is, who am I? Who am I? Well, we think we know who we are. We think we know who we want to be. It's a question of identity, right? Who am I? See, we live in a time, just like we want to define who God is on our own, we live in a time and a culture where we love to create our own identities. And so you can change who you are. You can change your career. You can change your location. You can change what you wear, the people you hang out with, the places you frequent. You can make your own identity, or you can just go on social media and you create one that's not even true. You can create a couple if you want to. But none of it's real. None of it's right. And left to our own, when we start to assume the role of identity creator, we almost always enslave ourselves. Actually, we do always enslave ourselves. And sometimes we take other people with us. So if you've created your own identity, you have enslaved yourself to that identity. That is what drives you to live. That's what you fight for. That's what you sacrifice for. So I want to give you just a few examples of identities to watch out for that I think are prominent in our culture and in our area. The first identity to be careful for is I am in control. I am in control. I got this, right? Like my house projects. I'm in control. This is ultimately pride, right? God opposes the pride. This leads nowhere but on a downward spiral. It ruins us. Why? Because you're not. We're not in control. And we really know that at the core, but somehow the more that life teaches us that we're not in control, the more we fight to be in control. The more we fight and grasp to make our life something that we can control. And when we do that, we're either going to become anxious or angry, or allow our anxiety to lead us into anger. Those are the only two responses to trying to be in control, because you can't. And when you don't, you will either be anxious about it or get angry about it, or both. It leads to sin. The next one is, I am what I do. I am what I do. This is when your self-worth is built on what you do, your career, your abilities, your talents, your accomplishments, or sometimes we just wrap this up into the church, right? We wrap this up into religion and our Christianity. So hey, I wake up at 5 every morning, I read the Bible for 3.5 hours, and then I pray for 2 hours, and then I'm ready to go for work, and I share the gospel with 3 people on the way to work every day. I make sure I do that. And look, all those things are good. We have to do that, right? We need the Word of God. But reading the Bible is not your identity. And that's what we tend to do. We can very easily get caught up in spiritual disciplines which are intended to point us to God as our identity, and we take the disciplines themselves as our identity, puff our chest up, act like we're all that, right? We know the language. We know the religious rituals to go through in our culture. We can easily do that. I am what I do also enslaves us. It keeps us from God, which is tragic and ironic when we take something like reading the Bible and end up getting enslaved by it. So listen, what you do is important because of God. Your job is important because of God, but it doesn't identify you. It is not your identity. If it is your identity, what's going to happen when you retire? All of us at one point or another are going to retire under different circumstances. What's going to happen? Listen, I'll tell you what's going to happen. If you're lucky, you're going to get a party and a cake. And then you're going to take your stuff out of your office, and they're going to hire somebody else. In a matter of weeks or months, they're not going to think about you anymore. I mean, you might have friends there you're going to keep in contact with, but understand, that's not who we are. That's not what our life is grounded in. If it is, it's going to cause us to be enslaved to it and then to feel like a failure eventually, because it cannot hold you up. It can't be the identity that you need it to be. The last one I want to share is I am deserving of an easier life. This particular identity is strong in the generation that is coming up. I am deserving of an easier life. Which boils down to, I want the fun, I want the win, I want to relax, I want all the good without any of the responsibility, any of the risk, any of the sacrifice. I want you to do for me just because I am, right? Society no longer has a standard for us all to look at and go, this is where I stand. Now we all have our own little standard, right? We all have our own little standard so that we can be the greatest no matter what. Right? We can all get our participation trophies. Oh, you got a 45 on your exam? That's okay. Take it again. Here's a study guide. Enter key. You know, we'll let you take it as long, as many times as you want, because we want you to know you're the greatest. We want you to pass. We want you to get an A. So just keep taking the test. We'll make sure. We don't want to damage your self-esteem. Listen, I'm not talking about crushing little kids' self-esteem. I'm really not. There's something between harsh taskmaster and, hey, you're the greatest at everything, whether you are or not, right? Because I guarantee you, little Johnny who gets a 45 on a chemistry test, maybe little Johnny's not taking chemistry, whatever, all right? But when he gets a 45 on a chemistry test, he's probably excellent at English or at photography or at something else. There's something in his life that you can say, like, can we not say, hey, I'm good at this, but I'm not good at that? See, the result of undeserved, fabricated self-esteem on an entire culture is widespread entitlement and people expecting that their lives should be easier than it is, expecting that you should make my life easier than it really is. Because that's how I grew up. That's what I learned. And that's what I want. And some people, maybe some of you, are thinking, well, gosh, that's pretty extreme. I don't think it's extreme. I actually think it's worse than that. I think that the massive increase in violent crimes and sexual sin and pornography and adultery and perversion is a direct result of the expectation and demand for ease in life. I want my pleasure. I want it now. I want you to give it to me. And if you don't, what happens? James 4. We want, we covet, we don't get, so we murder. We take. We don't honor God. We don't humble ourselves. We have become our own God. Marriage is hard, right? It is. I love my wife more than anything in this world. Marriage is hard. It's harder for her. So it's hard. It messes with my identity. That I believe I should be, have an easy life, so forget it. I'm gonna do the one night stand thing. I'm gonna hit the bars. I'm gonna create a culture of friends where, hey, we can have friends and benefits, and we can get into all kinds of stuff that offends a holy God, and call it good, call it freedom. That is where all this stems from. I deserve. It's a lie. You don't deserve an easier life. We do not deserve, and listen, relatively thinking, you have the easiest life that any human being has ever lived on planet Earth ever. Okay? And can you see the irony and the insanity of sin? We still fight for more easy. It's a lie. And we have to be careful not to let this lie take root in our souls, because we swim in the culture. We watch the entertainment, we put ourselves in the midst of it, and if this book, the truth of God's word, who reveals who God is to us and what he expects of us, is not informing us in a way that allows us to push those lies out, we're in trouble. And we begin looking no different than the world around us. We're going to see that happen in the chapters to come. Now, God answers Moses' question, and his answer is pretty mind-blowing. Who am I? But I will be with you. That's another one of those, like, okay, this doesn't make sense, really, you know, in our language. Who am I? Who am I? Who am I, Lord, to do this, what you're asking me to do? But I will be with you. What's he saying? I will be with you. God doesn't answer Moses' question. What's Moses' question? God, look at me. Tell me about me. Help me see how I can do what you're asking me to do. God doesn't answer his question, but he gives him the answer that he needs. God doesn't evaluate Moses. He's like, well, I mean, you could use a little help here, but oh, you're so good. Give him a lollipop and tell him to go reach for the stars, right? No, God doesn't do that. God says, don't worry about you. You've got me. Focus on me. I'll be with you, and that's all that matters. That's all that matters. You don't matter. All right, so let's try to tie all this identity stuff together. God wants us to find our identity fully in him and in him alone, to find our confidence, to find our worth, to find our knowing of who we are and what we can do in him and in him alone, knowing that he's with us, that he's near to us, and that he's holy. He's big enough to do it. He's big enough for you. He's so much bigger than you to fill in all the gaps that you have. Look, even if you were to say, okay, let's look at my greatest strength. Lord, ask me to do something with that. It's still not enough. It's still not enough to do the things that God asks us to do, because the things that God is about are spiritual things, and only he can do those things. Now, we walk in obedience and allow him to empower us. We walk in obedience and we allow him to fill us and to display his power through us so that people will know it's not us, it's God. So Moses' question is whether or not he is adequate for what God is calling him to do. You ever do that? Who am I? Lord, am I? I'm not cut out for this. We're going to see this over the next 2 weeks, big time. I'm not, who am I? Let's evaluate me, God. But God's telling Moses to base his sense of self on him. God doesn't even go there with Moses. He doesn't even talk about Moses. See, if Moses was Hercules, Batman, and Obi-Wan all rolled up into one, or if he's a puny, pathetic SpongeBob SquarePants shepherd who doesn't know east from west, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to God because God is with him. God has chosen Moses to do this. And because he's with him, he's going to make it happen. He already said it's going to happen. Moses just needs to and believe that. What matters to God is him. What matters to God is that he defines us. What matters to God is that he is our identity. So, what defines you? What defines you? What matters to you when you evaluate yourself? Because I know you evaluate yourself. Is it my appearance? Is it how I look? Is it my weight? Is it my hair? Is it how secure I feel based on that? Or maybe it's that based on who I'm around. Like my perceived sense of superiority with people. Like I'm fine, I'm confident, I'm comfortable with these people because I feel at least equal or superior to them, but those people, I'm going to avoid those people because they make me feel less than I am, and I can't handle that. Where does your confidence come from? Or where do you hope that it comes from? Like, I can do this because what? Because I'm an expert? Because I know the right people? Because I'm a good negotiator, because I look great, or I can't do that. Why? Because I'm not good at that. I don't fit in, not comfortable. That's how we evaluate ourselves, isn't it? Did you notice the repeat in there? I. God says, look at me. Look at me. Don't find your security in you, you'll never be secure. If you are, it's a lie. It's a false sense of security. God wants us to get our eyes off of us and our false identities and look to him. And we can because he's revealed himself to us as I am who I am. The great I am is with you. And being able to say I'm with him has fundamental and paramount effects on your life. When you can truly say, I'm with him, and find your security and your comfort in him, that changes everything about you. It changes how you approach God and how you relate to him and how you approach all of life and even other people. That's what Christianity is all about. You and I, who have no ability to do what it takes to resolve our sin problem. You realize that? We have no ability. We can evaluate ourselves all day, and it doesn't matter. No matter what your evaluation is, it doesn't matter. From best to worst, without God, all we can say is, I am not able. I'm not able. But because of God, because of who God is, he's come to us as holy and exalted. We can look and we can say, I'm with him, and we know he's near to us. We know he's all powerful to do all that he needs to do in us, through us, and with us. And we know he's with us through the whole process. And so when we establish this new identity in the great I am, I want you to think about how it pushes against that control idol. So that we can say, I'm not in control. I know I'm not in control. I'm not in control, but I'm with the one who is in control. So I don't need to be in control. I can rest, and I can trust him. I'm not defined by what I do. Think about it. What could you fill in your I am blank that couldn't be taken from you at any moment? Any moment. I mean, fundamentally, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a pastor. Any of those could be taken away from me at any moment, at any time. But it's not who I am. I'm with him. It doesn't matter. If I stop pastoring tomorrow, it doesn't identify me. I still have him. And I know that my life isn't going to be easy. If you read the Bible, we should all know this, but it's okay because he's with me, right? I'm with him because he's with me, and he knows me, and he hears me, and he sees me, and he has come down. He came to Moses. He revealed himself in that bush as terrifying, and yet he's with him. Listen, there's no verse with your name on it in the Bible that says, give your heart to Jesus and all your dreams will come true. What the Bible says is give your life to Jesus and he will be with you no matter what comes your way. And he actually promises you're going to suffer. We need to understand that as Christians. And in this, in God revealing himself here in this way, we see Jesus. We see Jesus, who is the ultimate revealing of God to us. Isn't he? There's a pretty aggressive dialogue between Jesus and the Pharisees in John chapter 8. They basically, toward the end of this dialogue, they come to him and they say, you have a demon, right? You know, it's like, you don't start a conversation like that if you want to have a legitimate conversation. But they accuse Jesus of having a demon. Let's just go ahead and read this. John chapter 8, starting, I'm going to read a few verses, 52, starting in verse 52. And here's the accusation. The Jews said to him, now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died, as did the prophets, yet you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died, and the prophets died? Who do you make yourself out to be? Jesus answered, if I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. Something for us to learn in that. If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say, he is our God. But you have not known him. I know him. If I were to say that I did not know him, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him, and I keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. And so the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? And Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, what? I am. I am. If you don't understand what Jesus is saying, that doesn't make sense. But we understand. And trust me, the Pharisees understood. This made a thump in history when Jesus said this. If this was a movie, there would have been a silent hush in the city. The trees would have, the birds would have all flown out of trees, and the clouds would have come in up front of the sun. I mean, this was a moment in history. Jesus just said, I am Yahweh. I am the great I am. You want to know how I saw Abraham, how he saw me come and rejoiced? Because before this, I am. That's how. And they knew what he meant. That's why they tried to kill him right after this. Jesus is the I am. Jesus is the holy, transcendent God of the universe who came to us as Emmanuel, God with us. He came in the fullness of God, but he took on the form of a man, and he lived every day in the power of the Father, dependent on the Father. And he did that every day, and he did it flawlessly. He lived a perfect life. But it was on the cross that we really see the nearness of God and the holiness of God so clearly intersect. Because it was on the cross, that in this intersection of holiness and nearness, that we saw this greatest of sacrifices, displaying the greatest love this world has ever known, accomplishing the greatest rescue that the world has ever known. That's what this whole story in Exodus is pointing to. Because on the cross, God with us took our sin upon himself so that the holiness of God could be displayed as the great I am poured out the full measure of his wrath towards sin on Jesus because of our sin. He did it for us. And in that sacrifice, for all who trust in him, for all who rest in him, he has set us free to be his. He set us free from all of our slaves, from all of our false identities, from all of our false idols that we were enslaved to be able to be his and worship him. And that's why Jesus was able to say in Matthew 11, come to me. Come to me. Come to me, all who are weary. Come to me, all who are heavy laden. Do you know that's the result of being enslaved to a false identity, of not living for God, not giving ourselves to him, as being burdened, living life heavy and burdened down. Sometimes we don't even know it because we acclimate to it or we numb it. But Jesus says, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. So I'm not going to weigh you down. You don't have to clean yourself up. You come to me. You don't have to carry all that. Give it to me. I'm stronger than you. I'm bigger than you. I will take it. See, that's real freedom. That's true freedom. And so this morning, the call for everybody is the same, whether you're a Christian or not. The way to freedom, the way of rescue, the way to peace and strength and the power of God is simply to come and lay yourself before the God of all creation, the great I am, who has come to you to rescue you and promises you life and peace. So bring your burdens this morning, church. Bring your sin that has been burdening you and lay it at his feet. Bring your anxieties that have been weighing you down. Bring your struggles. Bring your ailments. Bring everything to him and lay it at his feet. And find your comfort in him. Find your confidence to live this life for him. Because you know it's the great I am that's calling you to come. The great I am who is able to keep his promise and promises never to leave you. Let's stand up.